What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words from Gramsci, as paraphrased by Zizek, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast. And this week, we kind of have, for a change, a little bit of good news, or at least a little bit of news that I think will delight many listeners, which is that abruptly, in the early mornings of the week on Monday, it was announced that Tucker Carlson and Fox News were going to be parting ways. And this is a totally kind of surprise move. As of last Friday, Carlson was on his show speaking as if, you know, like, we'll be back, and with no idea what's happening. And then on Monday morning, Fox says, well, that was actually his last show. And they said this even while they're still running sort of promos for Carlson appearing again. So it seems like something very, very abrupt happened at the Fox. And this, we don't know what it is. I think that there will be news reporting in the coming days and weeks that will flesh out the story. There's, you know, reasonable speculation of at least two possible causes. One is this sort of Dominion lawsuit, which Fox recently settled, and which Carlson was one of several major figures in terms of knowingly lying on behalf of Donald Trump's campaign to discredit the 2020 election. And that was a big egg on the face of Fox. And there's also been, you know, from a former producer, very serious allegations of sexual harassment and a toxic sexist workplace on Carlson's program. And that might have had a factor. We don't know. We will be finding out. But I thought, like, you know, Carlson's very welcome demise might be an occasion to talk about the sort of right-wing media and its place, and also to talk about some of the surprising figures that didn't originally start from the political right, but have sort of migrated there, in particular the journalist Matt Taibbi, who has been on Carlson's show and also on many other right-wing programs, like Ben Shapiro's program, and has sort of become a kind of mouthpiece for parts of the right. So to discuss these two kind of topics, I'm very happy to have Ryan Cooper, who's a managing editor at the American Prospect, a very fine writer and thinker, and who has done some excellent videos on his YouTube channel that sort of survey the career of characters like Matt Taibbi and Glenn Greenwald. So first of all, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
So let's just start with the Carlson thing, because it is sort of newsy and might give us some context. Now, I'm already hearing some people saying, well, you know, like, is this such a big deal? Carlson is kind of figurehead. It's like the king is dead, you know, long live the king. Ben Bill O'Reilly used to have that spot, and he was discredited and had his a sexual harassment thing, and he's out, and then Carlson comes in, and Carlson will be replaced by another Fox News knucklehead. And so I've seen this attitude on social media, kind of blasé, you know, does this really matter? And I actually kind of think it does, but I'm curious to know what you think about this.
Well, I think we won't know for sure what the like long-term effects will be until we know who's going to replace him. But I think what you can say is that this is a massive blow to Tucker himself. You know, the Fox has an institutional and structural reach that is like unparalleled in politics, I would say. I mean, I think it's probably the single most effective propaganda organ of any kind in the entire country. And he had the prime time slot on there. And as you said, you know, Bill O'Reilly used to have that slot before he went down. And when's the last time you heard about Bill O'Reilly? And the other thing you could say about Tucker is that he is much worse than Bill O'Reilly. Bill O'Reilly was a real a terrible person. You know, he basically killed that one abortion doctor. I mean, he put out a hit on him, call him the, what was his name, Tiller? And it was like, yes. Tiller the baby killer. He said that like over and over again until the guy was assassinated. But Tucker is just like a barely even veiled white supremacist. You know, he's constantly talking about white supremacists, talking conspiracy theories, you know, that like George Soros is organizing a conspiracy to replace the white people in the United States with immigrants. You know, he even name checks the name of it, the Great Replacement. He's just like, oh, that's true. And his show and his website have been infested with open racists. It's been repeatedly discovered at the Daily Caller and one of the writers on his show. And I'd bet quite a lot of money that there are more that haven't been found out yet. And so, you know, I think you could imagine him being replaced by somebody worse. But, you know, Tucker himself had such a personality that like he was clearly pretty good at being on TV. And also, I think that this Dominion lawsuit maybe put some fear into the Fox News brass that they don't want to gamble on somebody who is so dishonest, possibly. You know, maybe they'll put Hannity in there. Hannity's a little bit more gun shy about going just hog wild with the most irresponsible, you know, crypto racist type of stuff. Who knows? But I think, you know, you see him go down and nobody's deserved it more, as far as I could tell.
Yeah, I know. Tucker Carlson is a terrible, terrible man for the reasons you outlined and much more. And it is, and for that reason alone, it's kind of worth celebrating. But I mean, I would add that I do see a kind of distinction between Carlson and the other, you know, Fox News knuckleheads. Like Hannity is a kind of good comparison, as is O'Reilly. I mean, those guys are kind of GOP partisans, and they'll take, you know, their main thing is to push the GOP line. Carlson is a little bit different. He's like coming out of the sort of people who are to the right of the GOP who want to have influence on them. And because he was on Fox News, he could. And he, like, you know, very deliberately and carefully and persistently mainstreamed these white nationalist talking points and white supremacist talking points. And it's very clear, like, from the people he surrounded himself with, as you mentioned at the Daily Caller and on his show, that, you know, these are people who are like reading the Reddit posts and reading, you know, the real Nazi right, and trying to figure out, like, you know, what are the arguments that they could take from those people and bring to, you know, the Fox News audience. And it has had a huge radicalizing effect. So, you know, like, it could be that it'll be replaced by somebody worse, but it's hard to kind of imagine. And I think just like it's important to see Carlson for, you know, who he is. The other thing to maybe say about Carlson, which is kind of interesting, is, you know, he himself kind of had a trajectory. And it's worth kind of remembering that, like, when he first started into in media career, he was like trying to be like a more mainstream Republican and trying to say like, yes, I know a lot of the, you know, right wing press is like Looney Tunes and they'll lie. And but, you know, we have to create like the right wing counterpart to the New York Times. I mean, he gave a kind of famous speech at CPAC saying that. And he was actually like, you know, I mean, who created Tucker Carlson? Well, it was actually like CNN and MSNBC. Like, they were the ones who gave him prominence. And, you know, for a variety of reasons, most famously, like Jon Stewart kind of humiliating him on CNN, he kind of like, you know, lost those perches and ended up on Fox and ended up kind of like, you know, finding that if he couldn't win mainstream acceptance, you know, there was this large audience on the right that was like very eager to, you know, hear him sell crypto fascist talking points. And that was his kind of trajectory. And I think it's kind of interesting in that sense to, even though he started off further on the right, to see him as part of this larger pattern that I think you've limed of people like Matt Taibbi and Glenn Greenwald, of how sort of like sort of market pressures can push people in particular directions. So, I think so. Matt Taibbi might be a good place to kind of take this conversation to, because he did appear on Carlson's show and echoing a lot of right wing talking points and conspiracies about the liberal media. And I think that, I mean, what your YouTube show on him kind of does very well is give the trajectory and why it was a kind of surprise that this is where he ended up. So do you want to give a kind of sketch of who Matt Taibbi is?
Yeah, so Matt Taibbi was, he's the son of the journalist Mike Taibbi, who worked for NBC News for many years. And he got his start in journalism in Russia, right after the fall of the Soviet Union in the 90s. And he worked with Mark Ames at this tabloid paper called The Exile. And The Exile was like just the most grody kind of tabloid you could imagine, right? I mean, this Ames would write stuff about like prostitute reviews. In one article, Matt Taibbi wrote about ambushing the New York Times Moscow bureau chief and smashing a pie filled with horse semen into his face because they didn't like his coverage. So that kind of like rude gonzo journalism type of style, you know, crusading righteous critics of, you know, what was, to be clear, a total disaster in terms of like the neoliberal like crash privatization of all of these Soviet enterprises. It was a disaster for the Russian economy. You know, the Russian male life expectancy fell by like 7 years over a decade. And then, you know, you end up with this dictatorship under Putin.
I think that context is really important to understand. I mean, there's both a sort of cultural context where I think Taibbi and Ames, his colleague, were coming out of that sort of gonzo tradition, Hunter S. Thompson, you know, National Lampoon, sort of like a frat boy anti-system sensibility. And it kind of was appropriate in Russia because this was like, you know, it was the end of the Cold War, and it's really a moment of, you know, Washington consensus triumphalism, where the, you know, the smart Harvard boys and Larry Summers were going to go into like Russia and tell, you know, them how to, you know, become good capitalists. And as you say, like it was a disaster, and a lot of the mainstream press, because they were coming out of buying into the narrative, buying into the sort of Western triumphalism and what Washington says, they weren't seeing that disaster. If they saw it, they kind of justified. They said, well, you know, a little corruption is a good thing. It'll help the economy grow. And so one way to see, you know, The Exile is a sort of anti-systems response to a very corrupt and bad situation and a bad consensus.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, the I think most observers at the time would agree that they actually did some pretty good journalism, you know, about what was going on with the economy and stuff. But the other thing to mention about the exile is that it was super sexist, misogynist. Ames and Taibbi would write, you know, critiques of other journalists with just like blatantly sexist, you know, commenting on their bodies and that sort of thing in their book, you know, which is the supposedly satirical. Ames writes about how, you know, they're just like constantly sexually harassing their own employees at the exile. And it's like that nobody's ever accused them of actually doing that. But, you know, it's not clearly labeled in the book that this is a joke, you know, and even if it is a joke, it's a joke in extremely poor taste. And they, you know, just never really apologized for that for many years. Ames still hasn't. But, you know, it was just sort of water under the bridge because the exile was like folded up by the Russian government, basically. And Ames and Taibbi had to leave. And that was the end of that. I believe it was in the early 2000s. But yeah, at any rate, that's when Matt got his career as like a sort of similar critic, not quite as rude, but a critic of American, you know, politics. He was a rabble-rousing lefty. You know, he had a great article. He founded this publication. I think it was called The Buffalo Beast. Great article about how the mainstream media had basically suppressed the size of the anti-Iraq war protests in 2003. He had a bunch of really funny and good reviews of Thomas Friedman books that were published in the New York Press, I believe. And, you know, then he ended up at Rolling Stone, where he was, you know, the critic of the financialization of the economy, the big banks that had blown up, you know, the financial system in 2008. You know, he famously called Goldman Sachs a vampire squid. And so, you know, covering the corruption and the abuses that happened, you know, the mass foreclosure crisis, the way that the great article in Rolling Stone about the rocket docket back in Florida, where they are just rubber stamping these like blatantly forged foreclosure packets or whatever, that this retired judge who just like paged through it in 2 seconds, stamp it, you know, another person kicked out of their home, doing it like hundreds a day. You know, that was good stuff. And that's where he was up until about 2015. I would say, when he endorsed, you know, he was a big Bernie Sanders guy. One of the first to come out when Bernie had his then to be thought a completely impossible long shot campaign to run against Hillary Clinton in 2016. And he was one of the most prominent people to come out, you know, in favor of him, back when it was thought, you know, nobody knew that Hillary Clinton was as weak as she was and that Bernie actually had a shot, including even Bernie himself, I think, at the time. But yeah, that kind of sets us up for 2016 and then his eventual turn to the right. And so basically this all starts with the Trump Russia story. If you want if you want to get into that, cause, I mean,
because I think that's very interesting, because I mean, I looking at it from the outside, I sort of see his turn to the right from you know, the Eric Garner book and then the reaction to that. But I think the Trump Russia, you're right that the way he kind of interpreted that did mark a big kind of fissure, like within the left, about how to see that. So let's get into that.
Yeah, so it's both of those things, I think. But him and Greenwald and a lot of other people like him were basically like they hated Hillary Clinton. They're real critical of Democrats, thought it was a disaster that she had been nominated, but they also thought that she was going to win for sure. And so they were really, you know, the Trump Russia thing, it just triggered all of the anti-surveillance state, anti-national security state, you know, sort of buttons that these guys have, thinking of the, you know, the spy apparatus, with some justification, to be fair, is like basically illegitimate, don't believe anything they say. And so the idea that like American intelligence was correctly identifying what was a legitimate like threat to American democracy, namely that, you know, like the, you know, Russian spies had hacked the emails of John Podesta and the Democratic National Committee, and they were basically working with WikiLeaks to dribble them out in the most politically effective fashion to create as much negative coverage for Hillary Clinton as possible. And that was a big part of the emails story, which just became this like miasma of coverage, and just hugely damaged the Clinton campaign. Part of it was her own fault with her, you know, poor handling of the email server, but the Russian thing mattered as well. And so, you know, they just to this day could never really grapple with that story.
Yeah, I know their basic take. I mean, it took time to evolve, but I mean, as I understand it, their basic take is that the Russia story is two things. One is the Clinton campaign looking for a scapegoat as to why they lost and saying like Russia did it. They couldn't take the blame. And, you know, I'm a little bit sympathetic to that in the sense that I do think that, you know, the mistakes of 2016 that the Democrats, the Clinton campaign made, you know, like really were never systematically addressed in the way that they should have been. But they take that to be like, that's what Russiagate was about. And that's a bit of a leap. And the other leap is to say that the other aspect was that it's the national security state, the deep state, that you know, didn't like Trump because he's an unorthodox figure. He wanted to shake up foreign policy, and so they decide to straitjacket him with this Russia accusation. I mean, that's basically the theory, right? Like, I don't know. I don't think it was like quite there at the start, but that's basically what it's evolved into.
Yeah, I think that's right. And so that leads us into the second part, which is the resurrection of all of his exile stuff. Mm-hmm. So in 2017, he comes out, Taibbi does, with this book called I Can't Breathe, which is all about, you know, the killing of Eric Garner, you know, on Staten Island. People remember this, I think. And Taibbi did this, you know, reported book talking to all of his family members and a lot of people in New York politics. And I think, you know, I think it's his best thing he's ever done. It was a pretty nuanced and, you know, a rigorous look into how it happened, why it happened, and why there is the effort to do something about the cops was such a flailing, you know, disaster afterwards. But when he was promoting that book, this was right at the height of the Me Too movement. And so NPR interviewer asked him about what was in that book. And, you know, he had a sort of half-hearted apology that he posted on Facebook, and then a later, somewhat less half-hearted apology that was longer. And, you know, he kind of tried to pin the blame for all the bad stuff on Ames, which I think is unfair. But, you know, basically said we'd done terrible things. We'd been sexist and misogynist and horribly inappropriate. And, you know, we'd basically turned Russia into a playground. You know, we'd become the same thing that we were criticizing in the, you know, Americans. But that didn't help. You know, he lost his position at Rolling Stone and his publisher, and he was sort of cast into outer darkness. And go ahead.
And, yeah, no, I think I think you rightly place this in the sort of the Me Too context of, you know, like after Trump's election and the sort of, you know, like awareness that, you know, America had just elected this like horrific, you know, predator, knowing openly open predator to office, you know, like there's a kind of awakening and context. And I mean, there's two things about the you know, the accusations against Taibbi and Ames, one of which is like, you know, they came out of Me Too, but they're a little bit distinct from Me Too because, you know, as you mentioned on your program about Taibbi, like there's never been a person saying, a woman coming forward and saying Matt Taibbi sexually harassed me, like that has never happened. But there is a fact that, you know, like these guys wrote about women in a very kind of gross way. And if they were doing satire it's the kind of satire that has not aged well. It is, I really think it's coming out of that sort of, you know, 1970s National Lampoon kind of tradition. And there's ways in which, you know, like, you know, there's a lot of sort of 70s comedy that has not aged well. And, you know, like whether it should permanently tar somebody, like it's hard to defend, even if one makes the distinction that it's not like, you know, the actual harassment of persons in physical space. It is a kind of, you know, there's a kind of attitude in those exile pieces that's kind of, you know, like for me, like indefensible. But like, what's your take on that?
Yeah, no, I think that's right. You know, you can say nobody's come forward with a specific accusation, you know, though somebody did, there was a female employee at the racket, which was, I didn't even mention this in the video. Mm-hmm. This was the publication under The Interceptor is going to be affiliated with The Intercept at First Look Media. And it was going to be run by Alex Perrine, who used to be a friend of Taibbi's. Mm-hmm. And Taibbi, and apparently Matt behaved like, not in a harassing way, but in an abusive way towards one of the female employees, mm-hmm. that they had for this publication, and it basically blew the whole thing up. As far as I can tell, it never went off the never got off the ground.
Yeah, and I mean that whole thing in his apology about how, you know, we became what we were criticizing, I think that's actually like, there's some real truth to that, in the sense that, you know, like what was wrong with what the United States did in Russia in the 90s was like, it came in as a kind of colonial occupying power and, you know, like was just totally tried to dominate with no consideration that it's a place with its own history. And the exile guys, like they were kind of, you know, you can kind of see like, oh, yeah, this is hilarious society. There are all these prostitutes here. You know, women need to like really sex themselves up to like survive because everything's so miserable and it's great for us boys. Like, well, you know, like how are you different than Larry Summers? Except that you're sort of two-bit Larry Summers, you know, he's working in billions, yeah. And you're working for small change. But it's the exact same attitude. So, yeah, I mean, in any case, I mean, this kind of, you know, I mean, with the Garner thing, I mean, one could say, as you say, it's a good book and it's a very pertinent and, you know, radical book coming out of, you know, like the Black Lives Matter situation and trying to like really look at these stories and report them out properly. And so, you know, one could say somebody like Taibbi could think, you know, like I wrote a good book and it got derailed by these, you know, the things that happened 20 years ago. But I mean, I'm assuming that's this kind of attitude that had to have been there on some level with him.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is where, you know, you could really tell he's just like galloping to the right. Cause first he started trying to reinvent himself as like a centrist media critic guy, you know, so it's like, oh, we're not doing objective journalism anymore. He wrote this book that was first self-published on Substack. So he started his Substack actually, and it's called Hate Incorporated. And the cover has a picture of Rachel Maddow and Sean Hannity next to each other. You know, I mean, this is just like bargain basement, you know, like David Broder from the 2010s in the Washington Post. Like, we need to just report the facts, no ideology. And it was, yeah. You know,
I mean, it's like as if Hunter S. Thompson had become David Broder, like, yeah. As if like, you know, like I, you know, like I was doing gonzo journalism, but actually I was really trying to report both sides all the time with the point of view from nowhere. And I mean that sort of centrist turn is very interesting. Like he did have that like period for about 2 or 3 years. And you mentioned his chapel appearance, which I remember. And that was very odd, especially considering the Garner book, because he had come up with this, you know, like very detailed portrait of, you know, police execution. And then he's suddenly saying, like, you know, going on a radio program saying, you know, like, well, you know, we have to be fair to the cops. And like, you know, what do we mean by defund the police? Have they thought this through? Like talking, you know, for all the world, like somebody on Meet the Press.
Yeah. Yeah. It's sort of like Jonathan Chait-esque turn talking about cancel culture and, you know, the excesses of Black Lives Matter activists. You know, it's like what are you talking about, man? And I know that was a pretty unpopular episode among the Chapo listening crew. I found some Reddit posts about it where they're just like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm just cringing through my headphones listening to this tripe. But yeah, you know, and that folded naturally into his next turn, which is to you know, you could be a centrist, you could be David Broder doing this, or you could be a conservative doing it in an even more dishonest way, where you say that the liberal media doesn't care about facts anymore. And that's where, you know, he ended up going on, you know, podcasts with Glenn Lowry, you know, conservative academic, and John McWhorter. And then later on Ben Shapiro saying the same thing, you know, we're not reporting the facts anymore to Ben Shapiro, a facts guy. This is definitely an honest broker if ever there was one. And at that point, you know, it's just, you're just a conservative at that point, but he still had this sort of legacy fan base of, you know, rabble rousing, you know, critics of American capitalism, supposedly. And so it just made for an intensely awkward sort of transition phase. And that's where he ended up, you know, being the Twitter Files guy, probably the most prominent one, because, you know, Barry Weiss has long had a reputation as just like a complete numbskull, you know, who makes huge errors in her reporting and is totally dishonest about, you know, her history as being like a anti-Palestinian crusader. And, you know, ended up blowing his reputation up completely, I would say, as insofar as he had some legacy gravitas or something, you know, as having done a lot of legit reporting over the years. The Twitter Files was basically the end of it. I don't know how much you want to go into that in depth.
Well, I think maybe just a little bit, just to because I think it is a kind of interesting thing, both that Elon Musk, you know, formerly the richest man in the world and still very wealthy, decided, you know, he needed to help his branding campaign with Twitter and justify his new regime by, you know, selectively releasing information about moderation under the old regime, with I think the idea that, like, you know, like the old guys are bad and you see I'm gonna fix things. And that Taibbi went along with it, which, as you said, like, you know, Barry Weiss, you could kind of see, but like Taibbi is someone who has done real reporting. And I think it's worth spelling out, like, what's the problem with, you know, like, what he did? Cause it seemed like, you know, like it is very problematic to like take sources, stuff from someone like Musk that's very selective and edited and, you know, put your name on it. And do you want to talk about, just like outline, yeah, what are the problems with that, the Twitter Files?
Yeah, I mean, basically, I think there's two problems. You know, they basically are trying to construct this narrative that the government was basically running to Twitter and be like, censor these conservative posts about Hunter Biden and about, like, you know, other things that are inconvenient for Democrats. And basically Twitter was working hand in glove with the, you know, the previous, with the government, the deep state, you know, that the sort of part and parcel with the Russia stuff that we were talking about earlier, you know, that mm-hmm. Trump was being stitched up by the spies or whoever. And, you know, while it is true that the government, various government agencies, the FBI, the CISA, I forget the acronym, but like they were in communication with Twitter. There was some former FBI people who worked at high levels in the Twitter executive team, you know, making these sort of decisions. But they just hugely exaggerated the scope of how receptive Twitter was. So.
No, I mean, I think that's a kind of a key point throughout all the Twitter Files, including the stuff Weiss presented, which is there's two aspects. One is outside sources were trying to influence what Twitter was doing. But I mean, that's hardly news, right? Like, one would expect political campaigns, you know, people like to work the refs. You know, and it's not that surprising. I mean, but the other aspect was, you know, like Twitter, you know, there was an internal debate, but like it seemed like for most of the occasions, Twitter handled this quite well. Like that, you know, like they were rightly skeptical of some of the intelligence agency stuff that they were getting and stuff from what was that group, Hamilton 69 or whatever, which was, you know, like kind of presenting a very you know, like very fraudulent kind of narrative, and it seemed like, you know, like, you know, within the context of like any human agency institution where you're gonna have flawed people, imperfect information, like when I was like looking at this stuff, it always seemed like, you know, like actually Twitter is doing pretty good. Like they're trying to like really figure out, you know, like what's the agenda here, what's a legitimate complaint, what's not. That's what you do when you have content moderation. And but continue. Yes.
Yeah. So Taibbi said, you know, before Congress that, you know, that these, this group of institutions, the Election Integrity Project, which is an academic, you know, private thing, had sent like 22 million tweets before the election to be censored. The actual, that number was a study about disinformation that happened after the election. So it included that many tweets. Not that they were sent to Twitter to be censored or whatever, because it included anybody talking about this stuff, people debunking it too. So it was trying to track how the, you know, how misinformation spread across Twitter. Before the election, they only sent about 3,000 or something like that, a few thousand tweets that they flagged, they sent to Twitter saying like, these are problematic and you should look at them. Twitter left almost all of those up, like the majority of them, large majority, it put notes on them. And as you're saying, you know, a lot of those tweets were legitimately like a serious concern. Some of them they had fake information about when voting happened. There was a guy who went by Ricky Vaughn on Twitter, who was actually convicted of civil rights violations for attempting to trick black voters into voting in the wrong day, or telling them they could vote by mail in states where they can't, and like trying to imitate the Hillary Clinton campaign to like to disenfranchise people, to take their votes away. And that guy's going to prison. You know, these can be crimes if you do it in a way that violates civil rights. So, you know, I don't have a
and
problem.
And actually, that guy, Ricky Vaughn, I mean, I know him, and I think you probably would have encountered him in the kind of, you know, 2014, 2015 Twitter. Like he was like, he's like a Nazi. He's like one of the lead kind of racist and like, you know, led a lot of harassment campaigns. But I mean, you know, like that, you could say that's within free speech, but you know, like once you're like trying to like mislead people so they can't be vote, that's you're in a whole different territory. So I mean, there's a Taibbi's Twitter files journalism, I think for the reasons you outlined, left a lot to be desired. And like, as if the, and then it was widely, you know, criticized. And, you know, it's a famous appearance he had with Mehdi Hasan on MSNBC, where, you know, like, I think Taibbi came out looking very bad because, you know, he could not answer a lot of these criticisms. And so that's already a kind of, you know, you're stepping on a bunch of rakes there. But to like top everything off, like, it, you know, like he ends up having a falling off with Elon Musk.
Yeah. Yeah. The one that to top the cap that off the discussion about the Twitter files thing. The other thing that I neglected to mention is the fact that Trump was also doing the same thing. Yes. He was sending tweets to Twitter. He sent one of Chrissy Teigen, just calling Trump a nasty name to try to get that taken down. It wasn't taken down. And, you know, Taibbi didn't give us this context, probably because Musk didn't give him any data on this stuff. Mm-hmm. But it was like, if you were actually worried about biased moderation decisions, you would look at what the conservatives were doing, too. Of course, they were flagging tweets to Twitter. And you know, they may have had perfectly, you know, legitimate right to do so. We haven't really seen a full accounting of it. I mean, the Election Integrity Project thing concluded that the vast majority of misinformation, almost all of it, was on the right, which is not surprising. But there may be some lefties doing bad stuff too. Now, as you say, you know, one of the questions that Mehdi Hasan asked was about Elon Musk working with the government of Narendra Modi to censor a documentary in India that is critical of the Modi government. And this is a guy who came in, you know, it's like, I'm Mr. Free Speech. I'm defending free speech from the attack of the woke mind virus or whatever. And here, you know, he's just a huge liar. You know, of course he is. This is how he runs all of his companies. 10 years ago, he said in 10 years, I'm going to have a man on Mars. You know, no. And so when Substack was working on its notes thing, which is basically a Twitter clone, Musk, you know, flew off the handle and he banned all, for at least temporarily, he banned people interacting with tweets that had links to Substack stuff. And he's, you know, deplatformed the Substack account. You know, an attempt to like basically prevent them from trying to horn in on his business. Well, where does Taibbi make most of his money? It's on Substack. And so Taibbi said, well, I'm going to quit Twitter now and I'm just going over to Substack. And so in retaliation, Musk temporarily, again, I believe, blocked him from being searched on Twitter, and including all of his Twitter file stuff. He couldn't find it for a while. And it was just, you know, just his loyal toady just threw him right over the side because he was caught in the crossfire of a different company trying to profit off Musk ruining Twitter. And it just goes to show you, you know, the debasement of people like this.
Yeah, no, it is an utter debasement. And it's all the more shocking because, you know, this is a guy who famously, like, you know, really made his mark as a critic of Goldman Sachs and of, you know, the sort of servile press that, you know, doesn't criticize corporations. And he has totally, you know, remade himself into the sort of attack dog for Musk, but not even like an attack dog who can then be discarded when he's no longer of use to Musk. It is a humiliation. I want to just step back a little bit. Like you know, we've gone over the trajectory of his career, and maybe just hit on a few larger points about like where this trajectory comes from, this sort of, you know, what I think of as sort of post-left movement that one sees in people like Glenn Greenwald, I think maybe Fang of The Intercept as well, and there's a few other people that kind of fall into this. There seems to be like a bunch of different sources, one of which is I think we see very clearly in what you've outlined in Taibbi's career. These are people who had a kind of like an economic critique and a very good economic critique, and but were really sort of class first, or but you know, like didn't see other problems of social hierarchy, in particular in Taibbi's case of gender, right? And so like once the left, you know, starts to, you know, like there's a new surge in feminism that seems to like unsettle people, and one sees that in like other things, like the sort of on the trans issue as well. Like there are people, you know, who come from a liberal or left liberal or even left background who, like, you know, are get unsettled by social movements from subaltern groups that they really haven't thought about, or of whom they have sort of very conventional ideas. Like, so do you think that's like, that seems to be like one of the major sparks?
Yeah, I think you definitely see that there's a sort of latent conservatism, you know, in this like basically Gen X type of pundits.
Yeah. Real, you know, bro. They're real bros. They have a real bro culture. And
yeah, a real bro culture that against this sort of like puritanical ish turn that's kind of happened with the, you know, for understandable reasons with Me Too. And, you know, I mean, people coming out of a super like what used to be a much more sexist and homophobic culture, for sure. And I think you see, you know, my friend John Gans had a post about the Sorelian left.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a reference to Georges Sorel, who is this French guy. And he was a sort of left, like a syndicalist.
Yeah. He's a sort of like left, but not of the sort of communist left, but sort of more, you know, very French and like, you know, like let's just blow things up. Let's just, you know, let's just riot and let's over anti-system thinker is maybe one way to think of it.
Yeah. And he hated liberal democracy most of all. And I think that you see a sort of similar type of tendency in thinking that liberal Democrats are the worst forces in American, you know, politics. They take the, you know, Obama years, the drone war, the fact that Obama embraced the Bush security state, and just like basically say that this is a thing that must be opposed. Gantz has a nice little quote about this. Quote, only the radical right appears to the Sorellian leftists to be authentically anti-bourgeois, truly unassimilable into the corrupt framework of mainstream liberalism. This is why there is a lot of curiosity in these Sorellian corners about the notions and culture of the radical right, about nationalism, about populism, about conspiratorialism as holding a rational kernel on the subject of corrupt elite domination, about avant-garde ironic shock tactics to shock the bourgeoisie and so forth.
Yeah, and, no, that's right. There is a kind of, it's coming out of a place of anti-liberalism, both in the sort of like broad philosophical opposition to liberal philosophy, but also specifically liberalism as it exists in the United States. Liberalism of Clinton, the Clintons, Obama, and Biden, and seeing that as the main enemy, and therefore, you know, you're willing to ally. The enemy of my enemy is my friend. So Tucker Carlson hates Obama and Hillary Clinton, well, you know, he can't be so bad.
One more thing I think I'd point to that has to do with the legacy of the post New Deal order that starts coming around in the 1970s and 1980s. You know, like New Deal liberalism was totally confident about using the state to achieve you know, social goals, building big dams, setting up welfare programs, and that sort of thing. And one thing that happened in the 1970s with people like Ralph Nader, the movement against the Vietnam War was a deep skepticism, a sort of like, you might even say, crypto-libertarian view of the state as like the most important thing to do for the left is to restrain the government. You got to prevent them from building, you know, terrible dams. You got to prevent them from waging the war in Vietnam. Completely, you know, rational thing to believe in that context. And I think that a lot of people who grew up, you know, who basically came of political age in the 1980s and 1990s have a sort of like reflexive suspicion and hostility to the government. And so when you have Biden, you know, basically inaugurating a not a New Deal order, but a much more confident liberalism, you know, that just passed the biggest climate bill in history. And you're thinking about using the state to achieve ends, and even including, you know, defending Ukraine from Russian invasion using the national security apparatus and all that stuff, I think just triggers all this latent skepticism, especially in the case of Greenwald, who is much more just obviously libertarian in his basic politics. That, you know, people just are uncomfortable with that, with the idea of the government being a tool that you can use confidently and without, you know, too much worry about which way it's going. And in fact, you know, some of the biggest things that need to be achieved is to make the government work more quickly, you know, to remove some of that stuff that people like Nader put in. To make so that we can build, you know, power lines and whatnot. And, you know, it's not, you can't really point to like specific aspects of this, but I think it's sort of under the surface a little bit, you know, this notion that, you know, the proper leftist attitude towards government is basically suspicion and hostility.
Yeah, no, that's right. And it is a generational thing of like, you know, going back to, as you said, the sort of 60s and 70s, the disenchantment with what, you know, the Johnson and Nixon administrations had kind of done. But also maybe like coming out of like a inherent contrarian kind of streak or an inherent. Yeah. But I mean, a weirdly, like very credulous, you know, about the claims of like a Tucker Carlson, right? Like, or of a Ben Shapiro. Like, it's hard to like take the full honesty on a level, not because they're hostile to like Joe Biden. I mean, I think there's lots of reasons to be hostile to Joe Biden, but like that they're very credulous about the critic. And that brings up maybe the final aspect, which you did talk about in your YouTube video, and which we have to kind of mention, which is a sort of, you know, financial incentive. I mean, like, I think that explains the aspect of, you know, these are like Noam Chomsky, right? Like Noam Chomsky is not going on Tucker Carlson and criticizing the Ukraine war and saying like, you know, Tucker makes a good point here. This is something like a little bit different than that. And I think one has to say like there's an element of which people whose careers are based on media and finding audiences, if they find particular audiences drying up, they have to look, you know, you go hunting where the ducks are.
Yeah. No, that's definitely a good reminder to bring that up, because as Taibbi lost his publisher and his well-paying job at Rolling Stone, I'm reliably informed. Yeah. He sort of backed into this, you know, population of people. You have, you know, massive wingnut welfare, basically subsidy apparatus, and all these billionaires that are willing to subsidize right-wing content in all sorts of ways. Greenwald got, for example, a six-figure contract from Rumble, which is funded by Peter Thiel. You know, Taibbi, when he started putting, you know, right-wing stuff on his Substack, he got up to, you know, I think into the tens of thousands of subscribers, you know, probably pulling in high six figures, something like that. Greenwald supposedly is making between $1 and $2 million a year. And yeah, so there's the subsidy from the billionaire class. And then there's the just enormous population of suckers out there who are willing to subscribe to right-wing content to just be fleeced. Not only with subscriptions, of course, but with all kinds of brain pills, magic snake oil remedies to treat all the various conditions of old age. And, you know, when Greenwald went on Tucker, I guess he won't be doing that anymore. Tucker would plug his Substack, you know. So, I mean, you see just like the direct relationship of corruption right there. If you come on my show and you say the right things, and I'm going to get my massive audience of idiots to subscribe to your, you know, newsletter. But the flip side of that is that is the phenomenon of audience capture, you know, because they're subscribing for ideological reasons. That puts a pretty strict limitation on what you can say. And especially when you're talking about conservatives, they know what they want to hear, and they're not going to brook any, you know, compromise with reality or anything else. So you've got to keep, you know, feeding the hogs, so to speak. I think some of these guys, maybe in the very back of their minds, are a little bit worried about the fact that, you know, what they can report on is now heavily circumscribed.
Yeah, no. I think that's exactly right. You know, I mean, if you Taibbi in some interviews, you know, basically says, well, you know, like, I'm still like on the left. I believe in climate change. I think, you know, like, you know, police brutality is a problem, et cetera, et cetera. But these are not issues like he ever talks about anymore. Like what he's actually feeding his audience is on the right. And so you get a kind of self-censorship of like, you know, like you can believe all the things you want to believe, but if, you know, the message that you're as a public figure is selling all the time is the kind of, you know, Tucker Carlson message, well, then one has to reasonably conclude that's actually what your real politics are.
Yeah. I mean, if you're in that position, it doesn't matter what you believe. You know, what matters is what you say and what you advocate for. And, you know, it doesn't do anybody good to have secret beliefs you may allegedly hold in your head, at least for a while, about climate change or anything else. If all you're feeding is slop to the right-wing piggies, you know?
that's right. Yeah, you become a slop merchant. I think that's probably a good place to end on. We've gone a bit long, but I think it's a rich topic, and I'm especially glad to have had on Ryan Cooper. You can find his writing on the American Prospect, and I'll link to it, and on his YouTube, where he's done these, like, really, I think, very well done kind of productions that are like have a lot of thought and are very well written. I would strongly encourage everyone to give them a listen, because I think they really explain the kind of, you know, where some of these, I think, pretty important figures are really coming from. So again, thank you for being on the podcast.
My pleasure.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5HETIDE.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5HETIDE.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.